You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. On today's show, I'm joined by paranormal investigator, witch and tarot reader, Charisse Williams, to discuss her new book, The Witch's Guide to Ghost Hunting. We discuss using tarot on investigations, the variety of psychic abilities people can have, the etiquette of ghost hunting, spellcraft, and her upcoming documentary, Haunted, Indiana State Sanatorium. It's a real pleasure getting an insight into the utilization of witchcraft in the modern ghost hunting pantheon, and I'm sure you'll enjoy hearing from Charisse as well. Just before that though, I'd just like to update you on some good news for me. I am deeply humbled to have been invited to be a member of the jury for the upcoming Fortean Film Festival here in the UK, which will be taking place in September this year. So if you want more details on that, I'll put a link in the show notes as always, but you can also search for Fortean Film Festival on the internet, and that should take you to the website and keep your eye out for ticket releases. Don't forget as well, you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up for the Patreon. For $4 a month, you get ad-free episodes, early releases, bonus content, and more. A really big thank you to my three newest Patreons, Jody, Lucy, and PeterGuns08.5. Thank you, Peter. Nice to say your name on my show as well as the Ghost Story Guys. Mysteries and Monsters is available across all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can also find the mysteriesandmonsters.com website for releases, episodes, information, and you can also get your merchandise from the top of the page. As always, thank you to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. For centuries, witchcraft and the paranormal have been a combination until the recent era, but Charisse Williams now explains how it's time to embrace and amalgamate them once more. On today's show, I am delighted to be joined by Charisse Williams, a paranormal investigator, researcher, and tarot reader with over 20 years of experience, has a unique insight in both the fields of spirituality and witchcraft, and Charisse brings a fresh perspective into the field. Charisse, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. Thank you for joining me.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, this marvellous book that you've recently released, as I was saying it before we joined the conversation properly, I found it such a refreshing read, Charisse, because often when we talk about the subjects of both witchcraft and paranormal investigation, often I think, and I know these are certain aspects of this that you touch on in a couple of sections in the book, it's very easy to kind of fall into some negative tropes and cliches in regards to that. And yet your book, without sounding churlish about the contents, is a very bright and positive, breezy interpretation in regards to these subjects. So I'm very interested in the fact that, is this a philosophy that you thought was important to kind of promote more than we currently seem to have?
I do. I think, I have like a love-hate for paranormal reality television. I think it's great because there's so many shows and it's become so much more open to be able to talk about the paranormal, which is great. And we're also getting to see different investigative techniques and everything. But at the end of the day, paranormal television is for entertainment. And people like to be scared. And so I think that a lot of shows and even YouTube creators and TikTok and everything, it's to try to get a quick scare out of you to make you, nervous. So I feel like a lot of these things really focus on and play up the negative or unpleasant aspects of the paranormal, which, I mean, there are instances that scary things happen and there are unpleasant energies and entities out there, but it's not like you see in movies and television all the time. And I think it's important for people to realize that it is a little bit more grounded and just kind of a part of life.
Yeah, I think it is important. And I think that's obviously a lot to do with it, because I know you cover a section in your book where you're about having good manners, not just with the people that you're investigating with, but obviously the people and the spirits that you're trying to make contact with. And I think this is a very underappreciated aspect of paranormal research. And I think that ties into somehow the kind of perception of how people need to behave when they go on ghost hunts these days, as you refer to about having a love-hate relationship with paranormal television. I'm in exactly the same boat as yourself with that. And it's very interesting, because I was recently speaking to a gentleman called Mark Rees, who's a Welsh author and has done a couple of fabulous books about the ghosts and hauntings there. And there's a wonderful story about an opera singer called Adelina Patti, who fell in love with the country, and she bought a beautiful house and did it all up and built her own little opera house. But she was at the end of the 19th century, so obviously sound recordings were not the best. So by the time they'd got the ability to record her, and she was classed as being one of the greatest singers of the 19th century, she sang at the White House. Queen Victoria came out of mourning to see how good she was supposedly anyway, and came to make sure that what everyone was telling her about this woman having a voice of an angel was true. By the time they'd recorded her, she was deeply upset when she heard the recordings, because she thought they sounded awful. So now when people go to this property to make contact with Adelina, they play these recordings, which she was very vocal about the fact that she hated them, and that deeply upset her. And it's very interesting that when you're covering these kind of aspects of that, I think often people forget, if we are dealing with intelligent spirits and hauntings, then treating these people with a lack of respect is going to both upset and heighten the chances of it being a negative experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's terrible. And I think, unfortunately, that's what a lot of people want to have happen. They think, oh, well, if I go in and I completely upset this spirit, then they're going to retaliate and it's going to be so much more exciting and the evidence is going to be so much greater than if we just go in and treat the spirit with respect. But I think that is so incredibly rude. I mean, I would certainly hope that these people wouldn't go into the home of a living person and pester them and do things to intentionally upset them and be rude. So why would you do that with somebody just because they don't have a physical body for you to interact with? I think that is so, it's so rude. And I think that you can get activity by being kind, you know? I mean, I don't know. I would rather like kind of build that relationship or be kind and, or at least show respect, because some people will say, you know, well, some spirits, they were terrible human beings, they don't deserve kindness. So at least just respect and kind of get more interaction that way. I feel like that can kind of help open up more of a conversation. Whereas, yeah, you might go in and be completely rude and play this music that this person said that they hated in their life, and you might get a quick, you know, door slam or something, but then that's it. They're not going to want to interact with you. They're not going to want to sit down and have a conversation with you or give you the time of day. So, you know, it's what are you there for? Are you there for just one quick little scare, or are you there to actually, you know, facilitate some sort of communication and research?
Yeah, I would suspect and suggest that in a situation like Adelina Patti, it would be better to go there and read some of her glorious reviews and some of the things that people, you know, she had famous composers write operas primarily for her. She was feted across the world. She was held up as you know, one of the greatest singers of her era. So that, I think, would give you a far more positive response, because obviously, as you refer to there, Cherise, if you remind them of negative aspects of their life, that's surely only going to give you a negative response.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it might not be, you know, it'll just be like one, like I said, like a door slamming or something. And then maybe you'll get some yelling on an EVP, but I don't know. I would rather establish more of a connection than just let me have a ghost yell at me and then call it a night.
Yeah, very true. And I think, as you also mentioned in that section of the book, it's important to treat the people that you're with respect. And I suppose some people might find that a bit odd, but I think it can sometimes, when you're doing paranormal investigations, I suppose it can fall into that kind of sort of one-upmanship, or you're saying to people, oh, don't be scared, get in there, what are you frightened for? and throw some, and you know, not literally throw them into a room, Charisse, but I suggest, but you know, put people into situations that they may not be comfortable with. And I think that's a very similar kind of situation, that if somebody doesn't want to do something, then don't force them, because they're not going to be benefiting from that situation. They're probably going to be more worried about how they feel rather than what's happening.
Exactly. Exactly. It's just, I don't know. It's just boundaries. People need to have boundaries. Yeah. And I think it's also too important to respect how other people investigate. You know, some people might investigate a little differently than you. And I mentioned it in the book. Obviously, if somebody is being completely disrespectful to other investigators or the spirits in the location or something, speak up and say something. But, you know, everybody has their own techniques and styles, and even intuition. I think it's important to respect somebody's intuition. They may say, oh, I'm feeling like this is happening, and you may think it's a bunch of baloney, but, you know, at least just, it all comes down to just be respectful. You don't need to be condescending and judgmental.
Mm. Have you been surprised, or has anybody sort of indicated about the book? Because obviously the book's called A Witch's Guide to Ghost Hunting. And for me, that seems a perfectly normal title. Because for me, I think the history of witchcraft and spirits goes back centuries, millennia even. And I know you also mentioned in the book that obviously one of the earliest examples of this is from the Bible,
mm-hmm.
where I believe, is it Saul goes back to speak to the Witch of Endor in regards to some kind of prophecy and to get sort of spiritual guidance.
Yeah.
And I find it very odd that sort of only recently has witchcraft and the paranormal seem to diverge again and sort of amalgamate in sort of a malleable situation. Whereas I think for a very long time in the 20th century, they were seen as two completely separate camps.
Mm-hmm. Which is interesting because, I mean, witches are notorious for communicating with spirits. So why wouldn't ghost hunting, where you are communicating with spirits, and witchcraft kind of unite? I think it has to do a lot with, you know, for so long, witches were seen as evil, and, you know, they were either seen as evil and something that you don't want to mess with, or they were seen as just a joke and nonsense. But I think this is one of the benefits of social media, I think, in regards to witchcraft, is it's becoming more common. People are being able to see in real time, real people sharing their witchcraft practice and being able to see that, oh, okay, it's not something, you know, demonic in sacrifice that's happening and people selling their souls to Satan. People are seeing that it is much more of a, you know, it is much more of like a grounded, balanced practice, and it's just more accepted now. So I think that we're going to start seeing more of a merging of not just witchcraft, but spiritual practices in general being merged with the more, you know, traditional kind of scientific approach to ghost hunting.
Yeah, I think you're right there. Social media and the ability for people to follow tutorials or watch people at work or sharing their versions of witchcraft, I think, has really sort of broken down these preconceived ideas of it, as you refer to there about sacrifices and hanging around with familiars and these old fashioned ideas of witches simply having evil intent, where, you know, obviously coming from where I come from in the UK, there is a long history of the persecution of witches at the late 15th and 16th centuries, and, you know, King James seeing witches wherever he went, and that kind of almost maniacal obsession with witchcraft and this demonization of anybody that did anything slightly different. And I think when we look back at it, these were simply people, because obviously it wasn't just women, it was men and women, though it's very interesting that certain men were allowed to continue doing what they were doing, whereas the women were kind of carted off into places.
Yeah.
Make of that what you will. And essentially, they were just at one with their surroundings, be it what we would consider in this day and age, very spiritual, connected people who had a real understanding of their environments and nature.
Yeah. They were the healers. They were the midwives. They were the, you know, they were the people helping the community. It's always kind of sad because you hear stories of communities turning on these people who were healers and delivered the babies in the village and stuff, and then the village turns on them. or even just people who were different, you know, that maybe they weren't healers and midwives and everything. They just kind of lived on the outskirts of the village and were just minding their own business, but they were a little unique, a little different. And it's just sad that, yeah, throughout history, we've kind of just condemned anything that seems different or against the norm. And it's a shame.
Yeah, I think that's one of the key strengths of social media, because a lot of people are very quick to sort of criticize all of it for its negative aspects. And yet I think we often forget that it's allowed people on the margins who have often felt that they are an outsider, or they are different, or they don't just like doing what everybody else does, that they're not the only person that feels like that, be they in England or Canada or various states across the US.
Exactly. Yeah. It's actually a really nice way to unite people. People feel connected.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it certainly opened up my eyes, and I've made friends with people from around the world. That's not to say I've struggled to make friends here, but the conversations I have with my friends here, Charisse, are very different to the conversations I have with some of my friends from the States and Canada, as you may imagine. And that's, once again, getting that kind of aspect where you're able to open up and talk to these people about shared interests that you may not, because with the greatest respect, talking about Bigfoot or ghost hunting is not the top of my friends' lists. They may humor me for 5 or 10 minutes, and then they'll move on to what I was watching at television, or if I've had a nice meal out or something like that.
Yeah. And there's no friends quite like internet friends. That's another perk of the internet and social media. I have a love-hate with social media as well. There's definitely a lot of benefits to it, connecting with other people, other like-minded people.
Yeah. I was interested to hear that you had a very early interest in tarot, primarily. And I had to chuckle that you, as many of us, I would imagine, Charisse, when we first dip our toes into this water of things that we're really interested in, but we're kind of scared to ask anybody so we don't look daft or that we're naive or something, that yourself and your sister were under the impression that you had to be gifted your first tarot set. So you both bought the same set and then gave it to each other.
Yeah, that was actually my friend and I, my middle school friend. We were in, I think, sixth grade. So we were 12, 13. Mm. It was hilarious. I mean, yeah, we just walked out of the store and just swapped decks.
So what was it that tarot appealed to? Because obviously this is something else that seems to have really risen back into prominence, because I think up until about 30 years ago, these were subjects that were, once again, as with most aspects of modern witchcraft, have kind of come back into prominence, really. I think because people have broken down these preconceived negative ideas that surround things like tarot. And so for you, Charisse, what was it that appealed to you? Was it just that you thought it was an interesting subject, or did you have a real interest in the fact that these cards seem to be able to offer some kind of knowledge that you were unaware of?
I've always been interested in everything weird, and I was always kind of the weird kid too, you know, hanging out with friends, and I would be talking about Bigfoot and stuff. So I was always kind of a little different. But I was just initially drawn to tarot cards because they were, you know, they seemed just so mystical and what is this? And so I wanted them. And then when I actually started giving myself readings, I was like, whoa, wait a minute. Like, this is actually giving me some good insight. There is something to this. And so I just continued reading with them throughout my life. Anytime I was kind of going through something, which I was going through a lot often for a nice chunk of my life,
yeah.
I would pull out the cards, and they were just they helped to kind of center my energy. And they also just really helped to provide kind of clarity and guidance and confirmation and things. So, yeah, they've just always kind of been a part of my life.
Yeah, I found it very interesting because I think it's often one of those things that when anybody starts with the tarot as well, there's always that moment where you might give somebody a reading and you're like, oh, hang on a minute, let me just check my book.
My aunt and I still laugh about this because she'll say, you remember when you used to be terrible at tarot reading? I'm like, leave me alone. We all had to start somewhere. But yeah, she was the first person, other than some friends here and there, that I would give readings to. And it was terrible. I'd lay out the cards and I'd be like, okay, hold on, wait. And then I'd grab the little booklet and I'd be like, okay, so this means this. Oh, and so that connects to that. And she'd be so bored about 5 minutes in because I was terrible at first.
Well, with anything, it's practice makes perfect.
Exactly, exactly.
So I was very interested that you were sort of looking and explaining in the book that there are different sort of ways you can lay the cards out in regards to using them throughout sort of a potential ghost hunt. So you'll do a reading before, during, and after, which I think is one of those things that also seems to catch people on the back foot sometimes when they're talking about ghost investigations and paranormal location research and things like that, that for some people, they just seem to sort of say, well, why are we using tarot? And I think when you read your book, and there are obviously other notable practitioners of tarot, Dana Newkirk is obviously a prime example of someone who has sort of brought it to the sort of wider audience of using tarot in investigation, Cherise. So have you ever been surprised that people still kind of view it in such a way, despite the fact that when we talk about the aspects of spiritualism and paranormal investigation and witchcraft, these are just standard parts of your toolbox, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not surprised that people are kind of like, what, and have their doubts about it, because, I mean, there's still people who have their doubts of if ghosts are real. So then here I am pulling out my tarot cards. They're like, what is going on? So I'm not surprised at all that there are some people that are like, that's just weird and that's not going to work. But I know it works, or it at least works for me. So I'm going to continue using it.
So in regards to the aspect of how you use tarot, why you would do it before, during, and after the event? Because I think some people, you might do it before or during or after. But obviously, I know you make a key point of indicating that you like to do it at all aspects of this, sort of a before, middle, and end.
I like to do it beforehand because it just like people like to do some research on the property. What are some, you know, key events that happened at this location or names that I should be aware of? You know, and people prepare for their equipment. What kind of equipment am I going to bring? I like to do readings beforehand to kind of get an idea of maybe what kind of energies am I going to encounter, so I can be kind of prepared. You know, are the cards showing that maybe I might encounter something that's a little more aggressive? If so, then I might make sure to take some extra precautions to protect my energy before the investigation. Sometimes the cards can let you know, how does this, the energies at this location want you to communicate with them? You know, do they want you to be more direct? Do they want you to just kind of be more emotional with them or connect on an emotional level? So it just kind of helps to give some insight into maybe what to prepare for, what to expect on the investigation. Of course, it doesn't matter how much preparation you do, you know, spirits and energies have their own minds or their own plans and things can go completely different. But I think it does help to give a little insight. And then during the investigation, it's such a great way to kind of, I know, at least when I'm shuffling the cards, I already start to receive intuitive messages just when I'm shuffling cards. I like with client readings with humans, living humans, sometimes I get messages and things before I even pull a single card just from shuffling. So the act of shuffling kind of helps to center me and kind of quiet my mind. And I think it helps to awaken my intuition just in general. I always find that after I pull cards or even just after I shuffle the cards on an investigation, I feel much more in tune with the energies of the property or of the spirits. And my intuition kind of speaks a little louder. But the cards during an investigation can give you insight, that deeper insight that you might not be able to get with just the yes or no responses of, you know, light up my K2 meter for yes, or, you know, touch this rib pod if the answer is yes. It kind of helps you connect on a deeper level with the energies, the spirits, even the energy of the land or the property itself. And then after the investigation, it's good also to know, you know, maybe did you bring anything home with you, or how did this investigation affect me? And the cards can kind of let you know that, like, okay, maybe it depleted your energy, so you kind of need to be aware of that. Or maybe you did bring a little something home with you. So it kind of gives you some insight into that. But then I think also every experience we have, whether it's with a living person or not, we can learn something from or grow from. So I kind of like to know, you know, how did I impact the location or the spirits there? And then maybe how did they impact me, and how can I utilize that moving forward?
Mm. Is it something, because I'm often surprised that when paranormal investigators on occasions, they will try certain things in certain locations and it just doesn't work. And sometimes, and this can apply to all realms of paranormal investigation and cryptozoology and things like that, Charisse, that I think people try something and if it doesn't work, they just stop using it.
Mm.
And I know when you're covering this sort of, this guide to what you take and the items that you suggest people should use. And I was very interested to see you mentioning using a cat or dog toy, which I've got exactly the kind of toy you're describing in the book. That's one of those that any movement on it and it just starts to flash.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, I must have spirits because I never see the cats in my house use it and then it comes on. So,
oh, wow.
I don't know what's going on. Or they just do it and run off as cats are prone to do. So it's little things like that. I think sometimes when you think outside of the box, even if something doesn't work, I think often people just presume, oh, well, if it doesn't work, it's never going to work anywhere else. And I think, as you explain, that's probably not the best sort of philosophy to have, because if we are sort of dealing in a situation of different spirits in different locations in a variety of situations, it surely can't be a one-size-fits-all approach when it comes to the equipment that you use on these investigations.
I completely agree. I mean, we don't really know what the spirits are or how they even can interact with their environment. So, I mean, maybe there's certain types of spirits that can't interact with that particular piece of equipment, whereas you could take it to another location and that particular type of spirit is able to manipulate that equipment. But yeah, I mean, just like every human is different, every human communicates differently, and every human has things that they like and things they don't like. I think the same could be said for spirits as well. You know, maybe that spirit doesn't want to light up the cat ball, but then you have another spirit that's like, what is this? I want to, you know, mess with this. So yeah, I think it's important to kind of try different things at all different types of locations. Don't just try once and then give up because it may work the next time.
Yeah. It is interesting when I was reading that section that you kind of highlight a couple of things that it seems really have fallen out of fashion. Dowsing is one particular thing, which I think some people just seem to think that that has to do with ley lines. Mm-hmm. Whereas I know that over here, up until sort of the mid 70s, paranormal investigators would use dowsing quite a lot. And that seems to be something that's completely fallen out of fashion. And another thing is scrying, which I think is another one of those aspects of paranormal investigation that seems to be held in some kind of negative sense, because we've all got these, or we've all heard these friend of a friend stories about people seeing terrible apparitions in the mirrors and things. And it's kind of got pushed into a corner with Ouija, I think, in regards to the fact that, oh, it's an entirely negative experience.
Yeah. So yeah, the dowsing rods, you know, that is one of those tools that I think, and I kind of mention it in the book as well, that I don't like to rely just on the dowsing rods, because there is that element of, you know, kind of wishful thinking. You may be trying your hardest not to move those rods, but if you want them to cross, you know, your subconscious kind of sends those signals to your hand to make them cross. So I do like things like the dowsing rods, but I also like to pair that with maybe even tarot cards or traditional equipment. So maybe if you have the dowsing rods crossing for the answer yes, and then also your K2 meters lighting up or something, I feel like that's a little more compelling. Mm. But it's also, I think, one of those, you know, try it. It may not work and it may work. So why not try to utilize it? And then scrying. Yeah, scrying is one of those. I mean, I did mention in the book, I highly suggest, I never tell anybody what they should or shouldn't do, because ultimately, you know, I'm not your mother. You have free will. You do what you want to do. I can definitely recommend or highly suggest. And I do that in the book of highly suggesting really protecting yourself and making sure you're grounded before scrying, because I do feel like it is one of those that you really are letting your guard down with scrying. And you may be so focused on kind of the connection you're having with your subconscious or what you're seeing in the mirror that you might not be aware of the energy happening around you. But I think as well, kind of like the Ouija board, with it's your intention. Like I think I talked about it in the book. I personally don't use the Ouija board because of past experiences I have so rooted in my subconscious that when I go to use the Ouija board now, I'm approaching it with kind of that element of fear and like, oh, something might not go well, even though I know that's silly.
Yeah.
But when you approach it with that element of like fear or uncertainty, that's kind of the energy that you might attract. And the same could be with scrying. If you approach scrying and you're like, oh my gosh, I'm going to see the face of a demon in this mirror, you very well might see the face of a demon in the mirror. So if you approach scrying with any element of fear or uncertainty or thinking that, oh, I might see something evil in the mirror, you very well might see something evil. And it could be because you're putting that intention out there. Mm. So something unpleasant gets attracted to that. And it's like, oh, okay, you want to see something scary? Or it's just your subconscious projecting that into the mirror. So it's important, I think, with any sort of ghost hunting or divination or anything, to approach it kind of with a level head and, you know, having your energy centered and balanced before you enter into it.
Yeah. And I think it's good that you've mentioned it without sort of, as you refer to, you know, you're not telling anybody what they should and shouldn't do. You're just basically saying, well, these are the things that you could possibly do. And I think often it seems that people have these preconceived ideas that they can only use a K2 meter or a EMF meter, or they have to use a video camera. And as you say, most of us have got smartphones these days, which have cameras and video on that we can utilize. They've also got torches on we can utilize. They've also got recorders on that you can do EVPs. And I was chuckling at that section of the book where you mention Art Bell, because I've recently been listening to loads of old Art Bell. And one of the episodes I recently caught up from about 1997 was an EVP special where they were having loads of people with recordings of voices that they'd caught. And it makes me chuckle that, you know, 25 years on, this electronic voice phenomenon is still such an enigma when it comes to paranormal research. But it was also very nice to see you mention Jorgensen, which is one of those people that seems to be completely forgotten in the history of paranormal research these days. With the incredible experience that he had when he made those recordings of the birds in his garden and ended up catching a disembodied male voice, and it kind of completely changed his life. And he wrote a very underrated book, Voices from the Universe, which I think is one of those lost paranormal classic series that nobody seems to refer to anymore. So it's always nice when I see that someone has taken the time to actually look past things that have happened in the last 10 years. Not that I'm suggesting that a lot of people don't look backwards or know enough about the subject, but it's always refreshing when someone's gone that little step further, because I think most people in the modern era don't even know who Jorgensen was.
Yeah. It's and probably social media and reality television kind of makes it seem like paranormal investigating and, you know, communicating with spirits is this newer thing, and it's not. I mean, we've been trying to reach out to the other side for as long as we've existed as a human race.
Mm.
And yeah, I mean, there's I feel like anything that most things that happen today have in regards to the paranormal field and techniques and things like that have their roots, you know, even 100 years ago. It's kind of important to kind of know where this field originated and some of the people who contributed to it, which I admit I'm not the best with that. That's something I want to start kind of diving into more, is kind of more of the original people who contributed to this field and kind of helped to shape what it is today. I think it's important to remember those people.
Yeah, very much so. And I think oft, as with any field, sometimes people can get left behind who actually kick down the doors for everybody else to walk through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, YouTube is a fantastic facility for finding things like that. I remember a couple of years ago stumbling on a very strange documentary by the actress Margaret Rutherford, who's probably best known for playing Miss Marple in the 1960s film versions of some of those Agatha Christie books. She was absolutely obsessed with spiritualism. And there's a wonderful documentary where she's gone off wandering around some haunted castles with a couple of friends of hers who are spiritualists, just looking for ghosts all over the place. And some of the things, I think when you look back at it, some of the things are what those kind of statements that people say that, oh, well, when spirits are angry, they glow green, which is one of those things that I've never really heard, apart from in this documentary. But it's a wonderful insight into that world, because it was obviously made, I think, about 1962. And it's out there on the internet for all and sundry to find. And I think it's little gems like that that we've lost. And it is weird that it seems that, as you mentioned, the legendary Hans Holzer in the books, and obviously he's probably come back into prominence primarily because of the Holzer files, which is, you know, and his daughters and the work that they've done in a family, bringing that forward. But I think there are hundreds of people like that from both North America and Europe that just seem to have been left behind because it all happened before 1995 and cable television, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that there's so much that we can learn from these people as well. And I think maybe some people think, oh, well, that, you know, they're from so long ago that any information they have is outdated and, you know, we're in the modern era now. But so much of these people were ahead of their times, really, in the way of their thinking. And I don't think that there's any, you know, thing that's outdated as far as information and knowledge. Or, you know, you could read something about what they did, or maybe a thought or perspective that somebody had, and it could inspire you to think differently about something in our modern age. So I think that there's always kind of something that we can learn from people from the past who were doing the things that we are as well.
I think a lot of it gets tarnished with this look back at, as you referred to, it's almost as if they were all naive and didn't understand what was going on. And
exactly.
The situation you have with, you know, famous cases like the Fox sisters and some of the people that were wandering around North America in the spiritualism boom of the 19th century, and obviously things going on over here, and some of the people that were claiming to be able to project ectoplasm and hold these seances that were, you know, when we look at these photos, I think sometimes it does make you laugh, because, so, you know, clearly these are paper mache or linoleum or whatever, you know. These are not spirits, or they're real. I remember seeing one, and it's clearly a sort of half deflated balloon wrapped in a blanket, just sort of nailed to a wall.
Oh, no.
But it's one of those aspects that, in amongst all that, there were real pioneers and people trying their very best and pushing the boundaries of understanding. And I think, as you mentioned there, it's hard to unpick it all. And I think some people just think they kind of groups it all that if it happened before 1950, it's all stuff and nonsense, sadly.
Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, so, yeah, some of it is. Some of that is kind of laughable. Like, how could anybody see that and think that it's real?
Mm.
But even if you take just somebody's opinions, you know, maybe they did see this ectoplasm and it inspired them to think about the paranormal in a certain way. You know, you could be inspired by their thoughts of it while simultaneously being aware that, okay, this was obviously a fake circumstance. This wasn't real. But you could still be possibly inspired by the way that that individual perceived what was happening. You know, I don't know if that made any sense I just said, but
it did to me. You're all right.
Okay.
And I think it's a very interesting aspect. And there's a great chapter in the book called Psychic Gifts for Ghost Hunting. And I think often when you mention the word psychic or psychic gifts, people automatically presume we are only talking about clairvoyance. And as I've done this show and spoken with people and read a lot more over the last 3 or 4 years, Charisse, my knowledge of this aspect of it has increased 20-fold from what it was. So I've only recently, sort of the last 2 years, sort of begun to understand that there are far more segments to this sort of psychic gift than just the presumption of clairvoyance. Clairalience is one, which is something that I found deeply interesting, because, as I was mentioning to you before we started, it's something that seems to be happening in the current property that I'm in at the moment, where we get a really strong smell of cigarette smoke. Neither of us smoke. We're not in an area where somebody could be smoking. It's not coming from anywhere. It just appears in a certain, and it moves around the property as well. It'll happen in different bedrooms, different rooms, and you'll get it and you go, oh, smells like cigarettes. And then 2-3 seconds, it's gone. So I was really interested that you've given us a breakdown of the different types. So obviously that's one that I'm aware of because it's something I've delved into because of what's happening here. So for anybody who's unaware of these little segments of psychic gifts that are beyond clairvoyance, could you give me an overview of a couple of the others, please?
Yeah. So claircognizance is, that's my strongest gift. And it's also the most difficult to explain because I think when you tell people, oh, I got this psychic impression, they want you to share, okay, well, what did you see? Or even what did you feel? Or what did you hear? Claircognizance is literally just clear knowing. It's almost like you know, your brain is a computer and you suddenly receive an instant file download and you just suddenly have the information. And it's like, well, where did you get that information? I don't know. It's just in my brain now and I know it. So that's an interesting one. And I talk about it in the book as far as, you know, using discernment, because you have to kind of figure out, okay, well, is this just wishful thinking or do I actually know that this, you know, for example, you walk into a room and you just suddenly know, oh, this room belonged to a woman named Mary. Mm. Well, how do you know that? I don't know. I just know it. Like it just popped into my head. You kind of got to discern, is that true or am I just wishful thinking that this belonged to a woman named Mary? Like, where did that come from? So it's important. The more you work with your psychic gifts, which everybody has them, the stronger they get. They're just like any other muscle. The more you utilize it, the stronger it gets. So that's one of them, claircognizance of just knowing. A lot of people have had moments of claircognizance, kind of if you're driving home and suddenly you're like, I shouldn't go that way. I need to go this way. Where did that come from? That's a claircognizant moment of just kind of a psychic thought just instantly popping up in your brain.
Mm.
So that's a common one. There's also psychometry, which I feel like has been shown on some television shows, where you can touch an object and you receive psychic impressions from it.
Mm.
So you might touch an object and you might see the image of, you know, a gentleman or something that owned that item. You get different impressions that way. So that's another one. The clairalliance one. People may say, well, how could you utilize that with ghost hunting? You may start to find that when you smell cigarette smoke on an investigation, that is connected usually to a male spirit, or, you know, different smells might pop up for you connecting to different entities. You know, you might smell roses when it's an older woman or something. So that's kind of something to pay attention to. And then, what else? Clear audience is a good one. That's clear hearing.
Mm.
So you'll either audibly hear it with your ears as if it's somebody speaking or a sound happening around you, or you will also hear it in your own head. And that's a good one on investigations also.
Yeah. I once had an experience of clairaudience, which was one of the most terrifying evenings of my life, because it all played out terrible. It was a tragic accident that occurred to a dear friend of mine many years ago. And we were at a friend's house and we were all sat around, and he decided that he was going to go and see somebody. He was annoyed about something and he was going to get in his car and see somebody. And a voice said right next to me, Thursday, if they go, they'll die.
Mm.
And it's one of those moments, Charisse, that I look back on, and it's not just my memory of it. You know, there were several people I'm still in touch with who remember me saying, and they said, well, what have you said? I said, I can't tell you why and I can't tell you how. I just know. Because I could say, oh, I've just heard somebody tell me they're going to die. Even then, and even in, you know, when you're with friends and you have these strange conversations and you do things like sneaking off for a Ouija board session or something like that, sure. When it comes to something like that, people just think you're mad. And then when something awful happens, well, then is it your fault? Have you caused it because you said that something bad was going to happen? So something bad has happened. And it's a very interesting situation. So when you've been on investigations, have you sort of come across these kind of negative responses or situations where people have heard things that have caused them problems or situations similarly to that?
You mean like other people?
Mm.
Honestly, a lot of the people that I investigated with up until recently, I've started investigating with ACG Paranormal,
mm.
Which is Nat and her husband, Elliot, and Kat. I especially have been investigating a lot with Nat and Elliot. We're working on haunted documentaries, releasing films of our investigations. And luckily, they are both also pretty intuitive, and they're very open to me expressing my intuition. But honestly, prior to that, I hadn't. Most of the people I was investigating with, I mean, they were okay with me taking out my tarot cards and stuff, but they were all more of the kind of traditional ghost hunting and not so much relying on intuition. So I honestly haven't really had too many investigative moments where others are kind of connecting to their intuition or expressing it, or me fully expressing my intuition. So yeah, I don't really have an experience on that. I mean, I've had good experiences with people like Nat. She's very vocal about her intuition and things that she's picking up on. And it's very interesting when what I'm picking up on, what she's picking up on kind of correlate with each other. That's interesting. But yeah, luckily I haven't really had any, unpleasant or uncomfortable, difficult moments with intuition on investigations.
Good. I mean, I think it's interesting as well that, do you think that people sort of turn away from that because they're so reliant on technology, or they're under the impression that they have to rely on the technology, Charisse, rather than, as you refer to, trusting your intuition or listening out for things? Because often, you know, people have been mucking around with their cameras or messing about with their EMF meters or something, and therefore they're not paying attention to what's going on, or the noises, or the feelings they may be getting, because they're solely focused on the electronic equipment.
Yeah, that's happened a lot on investigations. I mentioned Nat. Her and I seem to hear things more than other people do. And it usually happens when people are kind of setting up their cameras and switching batteries and things like that. And her and I are just kind of standing and listening. We're like, did you hear that? And are we all like, no, we didn't hear that. So I think that there is something to be said of just kind of, I love equipment and I utilize equipment, but I think it is important also while you're investigating to set the equipment aside, or maybe just take out one piece of equipment and then just sit and just really kind of feel what you're feeling. Listen to your thoughts. What are you picking up on? What are you feeling? I think that's very important. I think people feel things intuitively more than they're expressing. But I think, like you said, with your friends, you know, you were hesitant to say, oh, well, it's because I heard this voice 3-4 times next to me say this. I think a lot of the time people are either one, they don't believe their own intuition. They get an intuitive impression and they're like, no, that's nonsense. That's nothing. That's just my imagination. Or they don't want to sound crazy, or they don't want to be wrong. I mean, there's even been times that I haven't said things. Like most recently, I can't really talk about it because it was filming for haunted documentaries. So I can't share specifics. But I was doing a tarot reading and I was like, I'm hesitant to say this, that I'm 100% feeling intuitively. The cards are reflecting it back to me, but it had to do with something that I can't prove or disprove in regards to the history or an event that happened in this one location. But I went ahead and I my intuition's never steered me wrong. And so I went ahead and I expressed what I was feeling intuitively. But so I can see why, and I'm somebody who is intuitive and embraces it and expresses it, but I was even kind of hesitant to be like, should I say this? So I can definitely see and understand how, people who maybe aren't as connected to their intuition would be very hesitant to share, okay, well, I'm feeling this right now, or I did just hear this voice or this name, or I saw this image. I think a lot of people are just kind of hesitant to express it.
Yeah, I think that's because people have this preconceived ideas of how they have to behave, I think, these days as well. That it has to be, I think they're so obsessed with the scientific recording or validation of an event, that anything else seems to be put in a box as marked feelings, and you can't really gauge that. But as you say, I think most people in life have experiences where they've had a gut feeling about a variety of situations that usually comes right, or they have a gut feeling about a job or a person or doing something, and it will usually spin out like that. And I find it odd that, whether this is just a part of modern society or the way we're told to just kind of suck it up, move forwards, that people are sort of, they've been sort of trained to ignore it.
Yeah. And I think too, it's because it's difficult to prove. And I think as as humans, and especially as investigators, we feel like we need to kind of prove ourselves. Mm. And a lot of the time in we are investigating to try to find proof of the paranormal. And so when you can't, you know, everybody can see a piece of equipment lighting up or hear a REM pod going off. You can't really, you know, you can say, oh, I heard this, or I felt this, or I saw this in my mind. You can't really prove it. And so I think a lot of people just kind of dismiss that because, oh, well, it can't be proven. So I can't share this with other people. So I'm just going to throw it out, which I think is not a good idea. I think you need to embrace that intuition. I mean, our brains and our bodies are the most efficient pieces of equipment and machine we have in our arsenal. So I think it's important to kind of work with that technology in our brain.
Mm. Well, speaking of technology, I think it was, there was one part of the book that really did make me chuckle. And when I read it, I thought, well, yes, now I've seen it, this makes complete sense. And it's often this process that whenever you've been to a haunted location or investigating anywhere, there is this perception that you have to cleanse yourself to make sure that you've no attachments, or you've not fetched anything home with you, or just to clean yourself down. Spiritually, as it were. And then your section, you mentioned about doing this with your equipment. And I thought, well, that makes perfect sense. But until I'd read it, I'd never even considered the possibility that here we are, if we're dealing with things, and often when I'm considering the aspects of the paranormal, I tend to fall into a category of believing this is some form of energy, whatever it's responding in, the way it behaves, because energy can't be destroyed, it can only change. So I'm a big believer in kind of that kind of route in regards to the paranormal and what's occurring. I'm certainly not suggesting that that is the answer. That's just something I think bears a lot of fruit for me in the way I look at things. I don't think that explains everything by a long shot. So when I read that section of your book, I just shook my head because I thought, why have I never considered that? Because now I've read it, it makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I kind of look at it as different objects hold energy. It's kind of like energetic debris or dust almost. Not only are you going into some dusty locations and actually getting dust on your equipment, but I feel like the more we use our equipment, it is kind of just absorbing or taking on energetic dust, and they need to be cleansed as well, I think. Like tarot cards, for instance, are notorious for needing to be cleansed. Some people don't cleanse their tarot cards at all, and that's fine. Mm. But I feel like sometimes, especially after I've done a lot of client readings back to back to back, it's almost like the deck gets cluttered with all of the energy because I'm tapping into a person's energy. The cards are helping to tap into the energy. So it's almost like they're absorbing too much energy, and then I'll go to do a reading and none of the cards make sense. And I'm like, oh, okay, it's because there's too much energy surrounding this deck. So I need to cleanse it. Mm. And I think the same could be said for our equipment. You know, it's constantly connecting to these different energies and absorbing it. And I think eventually it can kind of make the equipment maybe not work quite as well as we want it to. Giving them a good energetic cleanse every now and then is helpful.
Yeah, that's an interesting point you mentioned there in regards to tarot decks, because I've never really considered that, because obviously I've heard other people say a similar thing in regards to picking up the energies when they're doing readings. In regards to your tarot deck, do you have a set time frame that you would look to replace it, or will you hold on to it until it literally falls apart, Charisse? Or is it one of those things that the more it gets used, the more worn out the cards get? And I don't necessarily mean that in a physical sense, more in a kind of spiritual energy absorption sense.
I think if you cleanse your cards, it's fine. Like I have a deck that I primarily use for client readings, and I'm actually kind of debating with myself because the cards are getting a little worn. It's getting a little more difficult to shuffle. And I'm like, I don't know, but like, I don't want to replace it because you do kind of start to connect with your tools, and especially your tarot deck, you do kind of connect to it, and it really kind of absorbs. I don't want to say absorbs your energy. That sounds a little frightening. But you know, I mean, you connect with it. You know, you kind of have a little energetic bond with it. And so I don't think that the cards like stop working. I think more than anything, they will physically stop working. It'll be difficult to shuffle because they're getting so worn, but I don't think energetically they can be worn out. I will say sometimes you may, because the imagery is very important on the artwork and everything on the tarot cards. Mm. So sometimes you may, you know, be at a different point in your life that the imagery just doesn't work for you anymore. That definitely happens. But as of feeling like the deck is like, oh, I'm too tired to move on, or I can't do another reading, I haven't felt that. Other than, again, physically, I'm so sad. I think I'm going to have to get replace this deck because it's getting difficult to shuffle.
Yeah. Interesting. I don't know. I just wanted to make sure, because I know, like I say, some people are very keen on the idea that the cards absorb energy or guidance or whatever. And as you say, I think with any sort of inanimate object that you use a lot, as daft as, you know, and you were sort of reticent to sort of say it absorbs energy. But I think when you use something a lot, we have favorite inanimate objects, and we build a relationship the way it feels in our hands or the way it smells. It's the little things, I think. And often we can overlook that because we always are encouraged to get brighter, newer, shinier things all the time. And often I think it's the familiarity of certain objects that keeps us grounded as well.
Yeah, I agree. Like this deck, I like the way it feels in my hands. It's provided excellent readings, and yeah, it's like you said, familiar. It's familiar. I'm comfortable with it. The deck knows me. I know the deck.
Mm.
So I'm going to continue using it as long as I physically hold out.
So yeah, there's a wonderful bit in the book where you talk about the creation of certain potions for certain situations and guidance and protection and cleansing different aspects of both yourself and the surroundings. And I found it very interesting, primarily because it was really good to read a real breakdown of what you consider to put into things. And as I said earlier in the conversation, these are subjects that whilst I knew a bit about on the surface, once you start to dig into them, I'm really surprised in the directions it's beginning to take me. You know, things like moon water, which if anybody had said that to me 5 years ago, I'd have just gone, I've no idea what you're talking about. Now I kind of understand that it's water left out under the gaze of a full moon. Am I right?
Yeah.
Oh, yep. Good. I have been paying attention. So yep. When I'm looking at things like that, I'm really interested in these aspects and traditions that have been passed down through the centuries, Charisse. And another aspect is when you were on about a certain potion that you were using, you would use earth from a cemetery, but the entrance. And it was interesting that you were saying that some people are really sort of against using cemetery earth primarily because of the connotations of it. But I thought your explanation of why you use it from the entrance, very interesting. So for anybody that's not aware of these kind of little foibles like moon water and using cemetery earth, could you kind of give us a sort of deeper dive into what these are and why you would use them perhaps?
Yeah. So myself and many other witches and people believe that everything holds different types of energies. You know, different plants hold different energies. Like the lavender plant, it has protective energies. It also has energies to elicit psychic dreams. So you can incorporate these different things that have different energetic frequencies together to create an outcome that you want. For example, if you create a tea at night with lavender, you would kind of put the intention into the lavender. I kind of like to say you're like waking up or giving an assignment to the lavender. Like I'm waking up the property, your trait of psychic dreaming.
Mm.
And then you drink it and you can have a psychic dream. So yeah, it's really just about utilizing the different energetic frequencies and properties and characteristics of different items into your practice or into your ghost hunting to kind of create the energy or outcome that you are desiring. Like cemetery dirt, for instance, especially at the entrance to a cemetery, it's kind of this liminal energy. It contains this liminal energetic property. It's also a cemetery, which is associated with death. So it kind of can help connect you to like to cross the threshold into the other side, to connect to the other, to connect to spirits. So by utilizing that or just even kind of having it with you while investigating can kind of help to I don't want to say, I guess maybe not break down barriers, but kind of just kind of put you into that same energetic match, if that made sense.
I mean, I mean, it was very interesting for me because I love the aspect of this book as well is that, as you mentioned earlier on, you're not telling us what to do. You're basically just saying, well, this is what I do. These are things you can do. And here's some things that you might like to try. So when I see these things, as I say, because I'm kind of opening myself up to the subject and diving into these, I found the whole aspect of this, well, if you don't know much about it, I'm just going to be open and honest with you and say, here you are, have a look at this. And I think that's quite interesting because I think often when we talk about subjects like this, Charisse, it can be quite daunting for somebody wanting to dip their toe in. Mm-hmm. And as we were saying, some of these subjects have become so popular over the last sort of 10 years that I think it can be daunting for somebody that wants to sort of investigate and learn more about modern witchcraft and the way it's utilized and the way it can ground you and connect you to the world around you, that when you come across a book like yours, I think it's a really good introduction for people without kind of pitching it too low, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I appreciate that. That's kind of what I was going for. And I say that at the beginning of the book, you know, everything that I talk about in this book, each topic could have 100 books written about it. You could go so much deeper into all of, whether it's the witchcraft aspect of the book or just the traditional ghost hunting. So if you are interested in something that I talk about in the book, you know, maybe you are really feeling drawn to the cemetery dirt aspect, you know, take that and really begin to research cemetery dirt and kind of see how you can apply it to your own investigating into your own life. I kind of try to make the book accessible to everybody, whether you have a lot of experience in witchcraft or ghost hunting or you're new to all of it. I kind of just wanted it to have something for everybody to be able to apply.
Absolutely. Well, I found it riveting, I have to say, and deeply
Thank
interesting.
You.
And it's really opened up a few things for me because I find the way that you've written the book is a wonderful introduction without being too scholarly. It's just basically saying, come on in, have a look, see what you like, and take the pieces that you want and move on with it. And I think that's a really good and refreshing way to sort of entice people into it, I think, Charisse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I know there's one thing that you've mentioned, and I would love to touch on this before I let you go. Is this upcoming documentary that's due out at any point? I believe it's incoming as we speak.
Yeah,
and I'm very interested in this because I've heard you say that this venue that you've done this investigation, this documentary on this sanatorium is a mind-blowing place to go and investigate. So how did you kind of get involved in going to this place, and how did the documentary come to fruition?
So the first time I met ACG Paranormal, Nat and Elliot, Nat had reached out to me. We'd been talking a little while on Instagram, and she said, hey, there's this new location, new open for investigators. It's an older property. She said, do you want to come with us? And I had just seen a few days prior a post of this location. I was like, wow, that's not far from me. I'd love to go do that. So I'm like, what? This is perfect. You reach out to me. So this was last July, so July 2021. And I went with her, and we were one of the first groups to get to investigate because they had just opened the property for investigation. So we were, I think, like the third or fourth group to get to go, which was exciting. And just, I mean, it was literally just one thing after another kept happening at this place. I've never been somewhere so active in my entire life. And I don't know I think it's a combination of the spirits at this location and the connection that I made with them, as well as the fact that I was one of the first people to investigate, and it's not like hundreds of people had been there before me and I've heard everybody's experiences. So it kind of was just this special place for me. So I still have such a deep connection with this place. And then, we went back in November because we couldn't get enough. So we went back in November. And then in December, I went with Nat and Elliot. A director named Marlon from California had reached out to me, and he wanted to fly me out to California to do a documentary on a haunted boat out there, a riverboat. And that didn't work out. That fell through. The location fell through. So he was like, well, I already have this time booked to do an investigation. Do you know of anywhere? And I was like, I do. In a big sanatorium. He's like, all right, let's do it. And he's like, do you know, two other investigators that would want to go with you? And I'm like, yeah, Nat and her husband, Elliot. Like, this is perfect. Like, it is still kind of crazy how everything kind of fell into place. And we were talking about this on our last investigation that we filmed for our second film that's going to come out. Just kind of how we all came together. Merlin still even says he doesn't know how he found me because he was searching for psychics in California. I don't have California tagged or mentioned anywhere on my Instagram account. So he's still like, I don't know how I found you. So yeah, it was all, it's very interesting to see the timeline and how everything kind of literally just fell into place. So he flew out in December and we filmed there and it was incredible and amazing. And we all got along so well together and, you know, we all agreed, let's keep making more of these. So we established Haunted Documentaries and we are going to continue going to locations and filming documentaries. So Indiana State, Haunted Indiana State Sanatorium will be out so soon. I unfortunately do not have any release information as far as streaming. I do know all of our films are going to be streaming on multiple platforms, mm-hmm. You know, starting out on one or two and then progressively going to more of them. But other than that, I have no more information. So you'll have to, people will have to follow me on social media, CheriseWilliams.xo on Instagram or Facebook, and then also Haunted Documentaries on Facebook and Instagram for updates. But it's, I love it. And I'm so thankful that, you know, Marlon, Nat, and Elliot have come into my life and we all work so well together because we really do just have this great chemistry. And every time, you know, that we've been investigating together, just crazy things happen, amazing things happen. You know, we all just really get along and I'm able to utilize my intuition and, you know, scrying and tarot cards and things like that, as well as Elliot creates really interesting pieces of equipment that you don't see everywhere. So yeah, I'm excited. I'm so excited for people to see this and I'm so thankful to be working on it.
Brilliant. What is it that makes this place so special then, Charisse?
Indiana State?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I don't know. I don't know if it's one of those because it, like, maybe it's so active because it hasn't been investigated extensively. Mm. You know, you go to some of these, I hear a lot of the time of people going to, you know, infamous haunted locations and nothing really happens or it's pretty quiet. Maybe a couple of things happen. Mm. And I think it's eventually these spirits just kind of start to get bored. You know, I mean, night after night after night, people coming in and asking the same questions and utilizing the same equipment. And I know if I were a spirit, I'd be like, oh my gosh, this is night 2002 and, you know, getting asked the same questions. I don't want to answer these anymore. I don't know if that's part of it, is the fact that these spirits are so like, whoa, what's going on? That's one of the things that I felt when I first went there. One of the things that made me feel so connected to these spirits is so many of them there felt like lost and forgotten and abandoned. And having people come in, they were finally getting the chance to feel, you know, seen and heard and remembered. And that was really important to a lot of these spirits. And so I don't know. I hope it continues to stay as active as it is currently. Yeah, it's definitely a special place and it has a special place in my heart.
Mm. I mean, that's an interesting aspect that, as we were saying, there are notable haunted locations around the world where it seems that it's gradually getting less prevalent. Things aren't happening as often. And it might be, as you say, they might simply be getting bulk. Oh, God, not another bunch of ghost hunters. Come on. let's go into the attic and hide up there for the night.
Yeah.
Or it might be the fact that, as some people have said over the years, there are certain ghosts that seem to fade away over the years or don't seem to be seen as clearly as they used to. And that might be some kind of aspect to it as well. So. It's interesting that after everything that's happened over the last 2 years, and a lot of places, even when you are sort of going in these abandoned places on your own, a lot of us and a lot of people have not been able to do anything like this for a couple of years, especially here in the UK. You know, everything was shut down, and it's, you know, it's not just a UK thing. It's happened all across the world over with the pandemic. So it would be interesting to see how things develop. Has this kind of 2-year break that we've all had if any of these former locations where things seem to have dropped off, if this break for them, as well as us, has given sort of recharged their spiritual batteries in a way.
Mm-hmm. I did see, I can't remember the episode. It might have been Holzer Files, maybe. I don't know. Don't quote me on that. But they were investigating the Queen Mary after it had sat completely empty, nobody on it for, you know, a year and a half. And the person who looks after the Queen Mary said that activity did change a bit and in some aspects kind of intensified a little bit. And it's almost as if the spirits kind of got restless of like, where are these people giving us their, you know, they're not paying attention to us. They're not giving us energy. So, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of locations kind of shifted energy one way or another due to, you know, not the constant investigation.
Yeah. Well, I suppose it works both ways as well, because I would imagine you've got locations that feed off people coming in as well.
Yeah.
Get bored.
Yeah. Depends on the spirit, I guess.
Oh, well, Cherise, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been a
real pleasure speaking with you. For anybody who's not aware, where can they get hold of the book and follow your online work and your Instagram channel?
Yeah, the book, The Witch's Guide to Ghost Hunting, is on Amazon, paperback or Kindle version. And people can follow me, CheriseWilliams.com. And for social media, I'm most active on Instagram, CheriseWilliams.xo. But I'm on all the platforms.
Excellent. And I know, excitingly, that this is your first book and you've got another one planned, hopefully for later this year as well, have you?
I do. I may have two books planned for later this year.
Excellent. Well, based on The Witch's Guide to Ghost Hunting, I'm eagerly awaiting either one or two of your next releases then. So I look forward to that.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed the book. And I think it's a fabulous debut into the field, and I wish you the very best of luck with it. Best of luck for the documentary series. I'll keep my eye out, and hopefully we'll get a chance to speak to you again sometime.
Thank you so much. Anytime.